We are fully aware of the United States' concerns. We also know that terrorists cannot be allowed to attack anywhere across the borders. However, we cannot design operations the fallout of which can destabilize Pakistan as a country. Pakistan's army draws its strength from the bedrock of popular support. Come what may, we shall have to guard this vital fundamental on which we based our campaign right from the beginning. I can feel we are running out of both time and patience. If the people of Pakistan feel let down once again, their alienation with the United States will be complete, and perhaps forever. Chapter 26 Lives and Limbs. June 16th, 2010. We are at KAF, Kandahar Airfield, now, complete with the poo pond, dust storms, and rocket attacks. We heard the alarms go off last night around dusk. They said it happens about once every 3 days during morning, night, or limited visibility. They target our barracks and the boardwalk. 5 civilians were killed in the last few attacks, and there is shrapnel on the side of the building we are staying at. It isn't really as scary as I thought it was going to be. KAF is huge, with 25,000 people on it from multiple nations, including Romania, Netherlands, UK, France, US, and others I haven't seen yet. There are 7 military cafeterias here and TGIF, as well as multiple gyms. It's pretty crazy. I can't wait to be done here and get up to where we are going to operate. We had a briefing on COIN and some of the directives from General McChrystal. It was the standard stuff that we had been talking about since we knew we were coming to Afghanistan. I didn't know how dangerous the rocket attacks are, though. The Taliban have conducted 80 rocket attacks since January, and one of their attacks killed or injured 14 civilians. They take 107mm Chinese rockets and place them on a berm or stakes connected to a timer or a bucket of water with a hole in the bottom, so when the water drains, the rocket fires. The Brigade CSM, Command Sergeant Major, and a few other field grade officers from brigade were injured in an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, attack down in Jari. It is pretty crazy. Coming back from counter-IED trainer, we saw some Afghans outside the wire, and they flicked us off or shook their fists at us. Some hearts and mind campaign, huh? Journal of Lieutenant Timothy J. Hopper, 1st Battalion, 320th Field Artillery Regiment, 2nd Combat Brigade Team, 101st Airborne Division, Combined Task Force, Strike. Highway 1 runs west from Kandahar toward Helmand Province, through or near 4 districts, Agandab, Panjwai, Jari, and Maiwang, that were the Taliban's birthplace. Since 2006, the area had provided the movement an important military redoubt. To the highway south lay the irrigated green zone watered by the Agandab River. It contained tributaries, canals, wheat fields, opium fields, pomegranate orchards, and marijuana crops that sometimes grew 10 feet tall. From a soldier's perspective, grapes were the most significant crop. Kandahar's vines grew on rows on mud berms or walls. The rows presented staggered obstacles and protection comparable to the hedgerows of Normandy. Grape farmers built concrete drying houses that could be used as bunkers or rigged with improvised explosive devices. The region's lush vegetation varied in thickness by the season. During the late autumn and winter, the fields could be brown and denuded. During the peak growing seasons of spring and summer, the zone could feel as wet and thick as a tropical jungle. The foliage was so dense during the high season that Taliban guerrillas hiding in one pomegranate orchard beside a walled American combat outpost could sneak through the trees and toss grenades over the outpost walls without being seen. On foot patrol, every 15 feet, there seemed to be a 10-foot grape berm or a wet 5-foot-tall grove blocking the way. By 2010, the Taliban used their base in the Green Zone to menace traffic on Highway 1 and to infiltrate Kandahar City. It was obvious that the guerrillas had a significant presence in the zone, but neither American nor NATO intelligence had a clear picture of how large the Taliban force might be or how it had prepared its defenses. Canopies of trees and vines allowed the Taliban to hide from aerial surveillance. By early 2010, the American military's tactical rules forbade helicopters from flying south of Highway 1 over the irrigated areas because of the likelihood that the helicopters would be shot down. An exception might be granted only if the helicopters tracked directly overhead of a maneuvering ground combat patrol strong enough to prevent the capture of pilots if they were downed. McChrystal's campaign plan, devised in the summer of 2009, identified Kandahar as the war's most important geography, the center of gravity for Obama's surge. Kandahar was the Taliban's first capital and the Karzai's home region. If the guerrillas regained control there, the movement would enjoy the kind of unmolested supply lines to Pakistan that had fueled its national conquest during the 1990s. It would signal clearly to southern Afghans that the Taliban was again inexorably on the march. In the early execution of his war plan, McChrystal had been diverted by the Marines' insistence on having their own combat theater in underpopulated Helmand. Early in 2010, the Marines mounted a kind of demonstration assault on Marja district in Helmand, a hub of the opium trade. The campaign required great effort and had produced debatable results by the spring. McChrystal had infamously promised to roll out government in a box in Marja. He meant the Afghan government would deploy a mobile phalanx of Afghan civil servants to deliver services and established the Karzai government's legitimacy. The idea seemed almost implausible on its face. British officers commanding on the front lines in Helmand saw virtually no evidence of the Afghan government. Taliban forces enjoyed complete freedom of movement. Villagers had little faith that the government could deliver. In any event, the significance of the early American-led action in Helmand paled in comparison to the coming fight in Kandahar. If McChrystal's ink spot strategy of securing critical districts in the south was to succeed even partially, the Taliban had to be cleared out of the Green Zone. The area connected Helmand and Kandahar. The clearance operation was also necessary to secure Kandahar City. American generals sometimes sniffed at the Canadian forces as insufficiently aggressive, yet prior American rotations through Kandahar had not reduced the Taliban's influence either, and in some respects, the most recent American units deployed there had made things worse. In 2009, Colonel Harry Tunnell commanded Task Force Stryker in Kandahar. Tunnell rejected Petraeus's population-friendly counterinsurgency doctrine as musings from amateurs, contractors, plagiarized journal articles, etc., as he put it acidly in a dissenting memorandum to the Secretary of the Army. Yet during Tunnell's command, undisciplined, out-of-control kill teams had rampaged against civilians. 5 soldiers from a battalion in Tunnell's task force were later charged with murdering Afghans for fun and keeping their fingers as mementos. It was hardly surprising that the Stryker tour had left some Kandaharis shaking their fists as Tim Hopper's men from the 101st Airborne arrived. After Obama's West Point speech, McChrystal, Mike Mullen, and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates selected the 2nd Combat Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division to fight what they conceived of as the war's most decisive battle. The brigade had been formed for the invasion of Normandy and had shouldered 3 rotations to Iraq since 2003. It contained about 3,400 personnel, plus the 101st Combat Aviation Brigade, which fielded Apache attack helicopters, Chinook helicopters for air assault and casualty evacuation, and other aircraft. The 2nd Combat Brigade was ordered to Kandahar as Combined Task Force Strike, made up of about 4,800 soldiers, to carry out close-quarters counterinsurgency warfare from small outposts in the Green Zone. "You're the main effort of the war," McChrystal told Colonel Art Kandarian, the brigade's commander. In February 2010, Kandarian arrived in Kandahar for a pre-deployment site survey, to ready for full deployment in May. He discovered there were only 2 small battalion bases and 6 platoon-size observation posts in the zone that he was supposed to conquer. In Baghdad, Petraeus had built up small combat outposts shared by American and Iraqi forces almost block by block to enforce security. This would be the model for these agricultural fields, too. There were local villages to pacify, but the area was not heavily populated, except by Taliban. The landlords who owned the zone's orchards, grape, and marijuana fields lived mainly in Kandahar. They hired day laborers and sharecroppers to tend their crops. Colonel Kandarian, a balding man in his mid-40s with extensive combat experience in Iraq, rolled through the area with an armed escort. He sent his Afghan interpreter to talk to some children he saw hanging around, watching him. "What did those kids say to you?" Kandarian asked when the interpreter returned. They said, "You can build your fort anywhere, because when the gardens grow, the Taliban will run at you." Kandarian thought, if that's what an 8-year-old understands, what do the local adults know? "How far do you get on patrol?" Kandarian asked a forward American officer he met. "About 1 kilometer." "What happens after that?" "After that, they think we're Russians." As they planned, Kandarian and his lieutenants studied the history of Soviet operations in the Green Zone during the 1980s. It was not encouraging. The Soviets had sent 2 armored regiments into the Argandab Valley and still had not been able to hold it. Those were the battles that had taken Mullah Muhammad Omar's eye. The first elements of the Strike Task Force landing at Kandahar Airfield included engineering units that worked at a furious tempo to site and build new walled combat outposts along and south of Highway 1. By June, foot patrols began at an aggressive tempo. Strike soldiers discovered the unknown, one walk at a time. One of Kandarian's early decisions was to combine all bases into joint U.S. and Afghan facilities to improve the Afghan forces and to give American soldiers greater access to local knowledge and language while on patrol. The 1st Battalion, 502nd Infantry Regiment, or 1st Strike, deployed early on in Jari District. The regiment's Bravo Company called themselves the Bulldogs. On June 18th, one of Bravo's platoons marched on a routine patrol to a village. Staff Sergeant James Hunter, 25, an Army journalist and photographer whose family lived in Kentucky, joined the maneuver. As he walked holding his camera down a sandy lane, a massive IED detonated, badly wounding him. The platoon radioed for evacuation, and a helicopter soon appeared. Private First Class Benjamin Park, also 25, of Fairfax Station, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., lifted Hunter's body and carried him toward the chopper. A 2nd IED detonated. Both men died. With that double-tap landmine strike, the 2nd Combat Brigade's war of attrition in the Green Zone, a fight that would become, alongside some of the Marines' engagements in Helmand, the costliest in lives and limbs of the entire American war in Afghanistan, had opened. June 19th, 2010. Last night we went to a ceremony for 2 soldiers, Hunter and Park, that were killed from 1st 502nd. It was all the units from 101st that were still at KAF and some other foreign units. It was a long-ass walk to the airfield, where we waited around for about 30 minutes, and then we marched out to the rear of the airplane and had 8 ranks lined up on each side to form a corridor for them to bring the bodies into the plane. Not that I didn't know we were going into the shit of it, but damn, it's different seeing a casket with an American flag wrapped around it being carried by you while they play taps, and you have hundreds of other soldiers doing a ceremonial salute. I really don't want to go home like that. Some of the soldiers were a little freaked, but I was surprised that, so far, everyone seems pretty resilient. I mean, we are only in second week, though, and still sitting around at KAF with not much to worry about except rocket attacks. I haven't really gotten much of a chance to call Jenny. I'm starting to miss her a lot. It is just weird to not really have the ability to just call conveniently. It was much different in Korea. The information flow is still just a drip from the faucet. So the guys that were killed were on a dismounted mission and hit a pressure plate IED. One was the PAO, public affairs officer, who actually took our battalion photo. Journal of Lieutenant Tim Hopper. Art Kandarian had joined the Army in 1986, out of ROTC at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. He had gotten to know McChrystal on the battlefield in Iraq. Kandarian's most difficult tour there was in Diyala province, as a battalion commander in the 2nd Combat Brigade. The brigade rotated home in 2008. Kandarian took command in March 2009, and was told they would be headed back to Iraq after rest and refitting. Only in December were they told, no, they were headed to Afghanistan for a combat mission. Normally they would have a year to prepare. This time, it would be less than 6 months. Some of the brigade forces trained in spare mountainous terrain near Yuma, Arizona. Platoon leaders arriving in Kandahar were stunned to discover they had to ford muddy canals and Argandab tributaries with their carbines held above their heads, as in iconic Vietnam photographs. This was a step-by-step battlefield where visibility was extremely poor and hidden IEDs were the main danger. The basic tactical plan was to provoke contact with embedded Taliban forces and then destroy them or force them to flee the region. The patrolling conditions would test the acumen of even the most experienced infantrymen. There were, in fact, many such infantrymen in the 2nd Combat Brigade. Soldiers, sergeants, and captains schooled the hard way about IEDs in Iraq and elsewhere in Afghanistan, who knew how the enemy booby-trapped footpaths and the best ways to walk safely. Often the Taliban rigged the easiest and most obvious pathways with tripwires and pressure plates. To survive, the veterans knew, you had to patrol down the least likely, most arduous routes. Never walk through an obvious opening in a grape wall, for example, when it was possible to climb over the highest point of the wall, however difficult. The easy openings were where the Taliban placed tripwires. Yet not everyone in Kandarian's task force had been trained for such yard-by-yard, life-or-death decision-making. Because of the strains on the Army's combat readiness after nearly a decade of continuous war, Kandarian had to fill out his Green Zone force by converting an artillery unit, the 1st Battalion 320th Field Artillery Regiment, to an infantry role. Many of the officers and soldiers of the 1st 320th had spent their careers learning how to fire big guns at the enemy from distant points, often from secure bases. They did not train routinely to conduct harrowing foot patrols. The 1st 320th was Lieutenant Tim Hopper's battalion, which partly explained the butterflies he recorded in his journal. He was taking command of platoon-level infantry operations he had never experienced. The lives and limbs of his men depended on his eyesight and judgment. Hopper was in his mid-20s. He had grown up in Lunenburg, Massachusetts, a town of 10,000 to the west of Boston. He enrolled in ROTC at Northeastern University. After college, he had served a year in South Korea before moving to become a medical platoon leader at the 1st 320th at Fort Campbell. The idea that he should lead a platoon through the most difficult terrain of the Afghan war struck him as strange. When he enlisted in the army, he listed infantry duty as 14th out of 14 choices in declaring his preference for assignment. But he was accepting of his duty. This was not the only place in Iraq or Afghanistan where the army had been forced to convert artillery to infantry. It was, however, an especially difficult place to try. June 22, 2010. So, the latest word is that we are going to this town Jaza, to the north of the Shuyans, which is where Bravo is going. It is a town where no one has really been, so it could be really good or really bad. We don't know. Well, I'm sure the plan will change a few more times, though. I got an intel dump from the S2 the other day. It was pretty good, but worrying at the same time. I mean, it is about 80% IEDs, and some of them have fucked up these vehicles we have a lot. They have these new IEDs called DFFC, Directionally Focused Fragmentary Charge, which are basically a big shotgun shell that shoots out a concentrated blast instead of buck spray. So they pack an old artillery round case with shrapnel and charge and cover the end with enamel to shape the charge a bit, along with some HME, homemade explosives. It blew the turret off the same type of vehicle I'll be riding in, about 75 meters away from the vehicle itself, and the engine block about 50 meters. Holy shiitake. Journal of Lieutenant Tim Hopper. We will be unable to succeed in the governance of Kandahar if we cannot eliminate a vast majority of the corruption there and set up a legitimate government structure. Period. Admiral Mullen told reporters traveling with him to Afghanistan early in 2010. He added, "We're not going to keep risking the lives of our soldiers if the will is not there to address these issues. Sending troops into Kandahar is like sending them to Chicago in the 1920s, Holbrooke remarked to his staff in Washington. The city administration is controlled by Al Capone, that is, Ahmed Wali Karzai, or AWK, the longtime CIA ally and a security contractor whose gunmen protected U.S. fuel and supply trucks. Ahmed Wali described himself privately to Frank Ruggiero, Holbrooke's deputy, as the most powerful official in Kandahar, who could deliver whatever is needed. In reply to accusations that he was a drug runner, he volunteered to take a polygraph to prove his innocence. His protestations worked. Across the Obama administration and within NATO, opinion varied widely about how dangerous Ahmed Wali Karzai was, whether he really trafficked opium or not, and whether he should be engaged as a necessary evil or removed from power. The British commander of RC South, Major General Nick Carter, favored tough love as the only practical course. McChrystal's intelligence chief, Mike Flynn, and a civilian advisor, Sarah Chase, who had lived and founded a non-governmental organization in Kandahar, advocated ousting Ahmed Wali, although it was not clear how this might be done. McChrystal concluded reluctantly that without Hamid Karzai's cooperation, he had few options. In mid-March, Flynn met Ahmed Wali at his Kandahar compound and told him that if the CIA or ISAF intelligence units acquired any evidence that Karzai was collaborating with the Taliban or engaged in major criminal activity, Flynn would place Ahmed Wali's name on the Joint Priority Effects List, or JPEL. This was the classified capture-kill list of enemy leaders and facilitators on the Afghan battlefield. American or NATO forces could strike anyone on the list without warning. "You're threatening me," Ahmed Wali observed. "Yes, it's a threat. But you're threatening us by standing in the way of our success." Still, ISAF never acted. American generals and diplomats tried to work with Ahmed Wali, as the Canadians had also tried, to persuade him to adopt the good government tenets of counterinsurgency. He was dealt with as a sort of unfortunate fact that was wished away or left to the CIA to deal with, as a senior NATO official involved put it. McChrystal and Flynn settled on a policy by which they identified red lines that Ahmed Wali must not cross, such as providing material aid to the Taliban. The implication was that they would not arrest or attack Karzai for routine bribery or racketeering. The red lines strategy, reported a classified State Department cable, would at least mean that American intelligence collectors will have a focus and could gather evidence on the kinds of drug crimes and massive corruption that might trigger more decisive U.S. intervention. The uncomfortable truth was that the Obama administration did not have the means or will to remove Ahmed Wali Karzai or other strongmen in Kandahar. Hamid Karzai would have to act, and he had chosen to leave his allies in place. In any event, some of the Americans involved feared that if they decapitated a mob boss like Ahmed Wali, they might touch off a free-for-all to control his abandoned rackets. June 26, 2010. Last night, a specialist from C-2nd 508 was killed by an IED following a complex attack from five different directions. They came up to a canal and were conducting a deliberate crossing and clearing it when they hit what they believe was a pressure plate IED followed up by small arms fire. All this stuff has me really thinking about what's going to happen up there. Not to mention that General McChrystal, the ISAF commander, was relieved of command for contempt of the president. General Petraeus, the CENTCOM commander, is stepping down from his position to take over. Every day, Kandahar is on the headlines and all the issues surrounding the war. We are really in the middle of history here, and it probably is not going to be a good thing. Damn. What did I get myself into here? I am not a tactical genius. I'm smart, but this doesn't come naturally to me. I keep trying to put myself in the mindset of the Taliban, but I can't seem to wrap my head around it. Regardless of whether I feel like I'm ready or not, I am being thrust into this and do not have a choice. My life is going to be on the line in the next month or so. I've decided I'm going to write a death letter for my parents, Jenny, and my brother. I know it is morbid, but I think it is probably a good thing to do, just in case anything happens. Journal of Lieutenant Tim Hopper. On June 22, 2010, Rolling Stone published The Runaway General, a profile of McChrystal in which unnamed aides to the commanding general were quoted making loose, disparaging remarks to an embedded reporter about Vice President Biden and the French, among other subjects. The article made it sound as if the officers commanding the Afghan war held Obama and other civilian leaders in contempt. Stan McChrystal was a disciplined individual, but retained something of a fraternity boy's imperviousness to political risk. He did understand immediately the scale of his error. On Tuesday, June 22, 2010, the day the story appeared, McChrystal was supposed to appear by secure video for an interagency meeting about negotiating with the Taliban to end the Afghan war. The session was postponed. The general boarded a long flight to Andrews Air Force Base to meet the president. The White House had previously scheduled a National Security Council meeting on Afghanistan in the Situation Room for Thursday, June 24th. Upstairs in the Oval Office, Obama accepted McChrystal's resignation after what the general described as a short, professional exchange. David Petraeus was already in the West Wing, waiting for the NSC meeting on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Reggie Love, the president's personal aide, turned up in the hallways, asking if Petraeus was around. Petraeus had no idea that Obama had accepted McChrystal's resignation. The general followed Love upstairs. He passed the White House national security team coming out, refusing to make eye contact with him. He sat down with Obama and waited for a White House photographer to record the moment and leave. "I'm asking you as your president and commander-in-chief to take command in Afghanistan," Obama said. Petraeus knew the only answer was yes. He tried to introduce his thinking about the planned drawdown of surge forces, that his recommendations would all be based on facts on the ground, as well as an awareness of the realities of politics in Washington and NATO. The assignment was a step down in authority, as Petraeus oversaw the entire Central Command area of operations, from Cairo to Islamabad, McChrystal had reported to him. As it happened, although he had backed McChrystal fully during the first half of 2010, Petraeus had somewhat different ideas about how to prosecute the Afghan war on Obama's timeline. His arrival in Kabul that summer would lead to a reinterpretation of counterinsurgency from Kandahar's Green Zone to the Pakistani borderlands. June 28, 2010. So, we are leaving KAF tonight. We are taking a Chinook up to FOB Jalawar. Four guys from my platoon went up yesterday. I was on the boardwalk getting some ice cream with Doc and my FO, forward observer, when we saw a couple guys from the 82nd Airborne. They came up and asked who we were relieving, and we said we were going up to the Argandab. They were telling us about it, and, man, I'm not going to lie, but it scares the shit out of me and kind of depresses me. They were telling me that it is really bad up there. There is a shitload of IEDs, and they travel in a file with a dog team up front and a mine detector, and that they are still losing guys. He said they, the Taliban, are using kids as spotters, and that when you see them, get down and book it. Get ready for something to go down. Same thing with the farmers. When you see them leave, something is going to happen. He also said these guys are not your regular Taliban. They are the Pakistani ISI-trained guys, and that they will ambush you and not break contact until rotary wing, American attack helicopters, is called in. This is going to be crazy. The tripwires are not only down at the foot or leg level, but head level, too. People get so focused on the ground that they forget to look up, so we need to look up as well as down. The orchards are super fucking thick, and you basically have to bear crawl through them. The number one thing, he said, was that every operation needs to be incredibly deliberate and take everything slow. Well, I am going to go relax and enjoy having two arms and two legs while I still have them. Journal of Lieutenant Tim Hopper. The initial phase of Colonel Art Kandarian's campaign in the Green Zone wasn't much different from that of the U.S. Army in the American West during the 19th century. Build forts in Indian country and poke around. The task force's engineering units designed a crude combat outpost, a COP or COP, as it was rendered in jargon, that could be erected in 10 to 14 days. The outposts were usually about 200 meters by 250 meters in area. The outer walls were made of HESCO gabions, manufactured blast walls of dirt held together by mesh wire, 11 feet high and 7 feet thick. The standard outpost design included rapid aerostat initial deployment, or RAID cameras, with infrared capabilities that allowed soldiers to watch their perimeter from behind the HESCO walls. The larger forward operating bases in the zone also installed big aerostat blimps of the sort General Mike Flynn had ordered in large numbers starting in 2009. These blimps were known as persistent threat detection systems. They allowed intelligence officers in secure quarters below to see for miles. From 6 kilometers away, I could see a guy holding an AK and tell you what color his beard was, as Lieutenant Colonel Brian Spears, who deployed to the Green Zone that summer, put it. Spears used the blimps to watch small Taliban groups as they shot at supply convoys on Highway 1. He could then order aircraft to drop a bomb on them. Combat engineers also erected tall observation towers where soldiers on watch could look out directly at the foliage. It was sometimes easier for the Taliban to spot the Americans in the towers than vice versa, however. In June, a Taliban sniper killed Brandon King of the 1st 320th, shooting him square in the face as he stood on watch in a tower. Forward American units detained suspected insurgents and used retinal scanners to log them in classified databases. But interrogations and human intelligence collection in Kandahar that summer rarely produced insights beyond the known fact that many Taliban fighters were from or trained in Pakistan. More useful tactical intelligence about Taliban positions and movements came from listening to their radio communication. The enemy had no means to encrypt their chatter, which was easily intercepted and translated. That monitoring allowed American platoons to anticipate ambush attempts and to stay ahead of the Taliban's reactions during combat. By far, the most urgent intelligence requirements were to map the enemy inside the green zone and avoid IEDs. The blimps and raid cameras could spot Taliban if they moved in open areas, but were less helpful in identifying enemy infrastructure and supply lines underneath the vines and orchard canopies. As the fighting intensified that summer, the Combat Aviation Brigade's S2, or Chief Intelligence Officer, undertook an elaborate mapping exercise to try to infer hidden Taliban positions from the sources of their firing. She plotted every engagement with the Taliban, air-to-ground, ground-to-ground, and ground-to-air, as well as trajectories of fire. The map lines were all color-coded. As the colors thickened over time, she hypothesized that the Taliban must be moving through the green zone underground, in a tunnel network. Guerrillas would pop up, fire, disappear, and then reappear across the map in a pattern that only tunnels seem to explain. Kandarian sent platoons to the places she identified and, sure enough, they found tunnels, some running almost the length of a football field. Engineers blew the tunnels up with high explosives. This became part of what Colonel William Gaylor, the aviation brigade commander, dubbed the Enemy Tactical Infrastructure Reduction Campaign, which went on well into the autumn. A problem, it turned out, was that some of the tunnels were part of an ancient irrigation system called the Karez, an informal network of sediment tunnels managed by local Afghan communities for vital water supplies. Some Karez tunnels had been watering fields in Kandahar province for centuries. There were similar systems throughout South Asia, the Middle East, and China. The tunnels were not on the maps the Americans had brought to battle, however. After commanders realized what they might be destroying, the Army research officer hired Rolf Mandel, a University of Kansas archaeologist, to map Kandahar's Karez system in order to protect it. American forces had inadvertently destroyed some or contaminated some and really irritated the people, Mandel noted. The Americans destroyed some of the tunnels. The Taliban blew up others and blamed the Americans. July 3rd, 2010. So we ended up pushing out today. It was definitely strange being out there for the first time. I thought it was going to be much more high-strung and that everyone would be more stressed out, including myself. Instead, it was more like a Sunday stroll. Granted, it was with about 70 pounds worth of gear, and it was 110 degrees. Almost like a maze of mud walls ranging from 6 to 12 feet high. CPT Schaefer stopped off and spoke with the mullah while we hung out on the street and talked with some kids. I gave this one kid some sour warheads, and his face was priceless when he tried it. I offered him sweet or sour. He proceeded to chuck it over a wall. Platoons depended on their most experienced sergeants to survive. Sergeant Josh Strickland had served 2 tours in Iraq and 1 in Afghanistan before joining 3rd Platoon, A Battery, of the 1st 320th, the Artillery Misfits. During his first couple of weeks at Combat Outpost Nolan, Strickland's patrols could not walk 100 yards without hitting an IED or getting lit up by Taliban from several sides. Listening to enemy radio talk, they learned the enemy knew they were artillery, not infantry. The Taliban said, "These are not real war fighters." They were wrong, but it took time and heavy losses for the 1st 320th to prove it. The first time Strickland's platoon got hit, he saw a young artilleryman burst out crying. The soldier screamed again and again, "I didn't sign up for this shit." In general, Strickland thought, the lowest-ranking first-time soldiers adjusted to the stress better than the more experienced artillerymen, because the rookies had no expectations from prior deployments. Because of Strickland's experience and uncanny ability to avoid IEDs, soldiers continually asked him to walk point on their patrols. He chose to walk 10 to 15 feet ahead of everyone else, so that he could carefully identify the best route, and so that, if he did make a mistake, it would cost one life instead of several. He was ultimately wounded and medevaced to Kandahar airfield 4 times. Each time, as he recovered in the hospital, a doctor would ask Strickland if he wanted to go back or go home. What am I going to say? He thought. He went back. Day after day, in platoon after platoon, they shouldered their loads, stepped out on presence patrols, and hoped for the best. They walked past villagers near their outposts who were generally neither helpful nor hostile. One elder near Strickland's base kept a pigeon that he would let fly every time a platoon departed, apparently to let Taliban know they were on the march. By July, the IEDs and the escalating casualties had rattled even the most experienced infantrymen. In Jari, the 4 companies of the 1st 502nd, Alpha, a.k.a. Hard Rock, the Bulldogs of Bravo, Charlie or Cobra, and Delta or the War Dogs, stepped down paths that the Taliban had been implanting with IEDs for at least a month before the battalion arrived. Every soldier carried 70 to 90 pounds of gear, water, and ammunition. They patrolled at night to avoid the sun, or drank water continually to stave off dehydration in heat that soared daily well above 100 degrees. The IEDs were so thick around the Bulldogs' encampment that they had to clear 100 yards at a time from the HESCO walls out. A lot of soldiers struggled with the stress. The first platoon of the 1st 320th started out with 19 men. After 3 patrols, they had 6 remaining. 80% of Bravo Company's personnel had to be replaced during Strickland's tour because of combat deaths, severed limbs, concussions, and other injuries. July 12, 2010. It was much better moving around at night, although it was pretty eerie at 3:30 a.m. when we were walking through the village and all of a sudden the call for prayer came on. I felt like I was in Call of Modern Duty warfare. We walked in the canal down to the fields. We were going to move towards the second canal, and we had SPC Spaulding using the gizmo, which is our metal detector. Spaulding is usually an iffy soldier, but he was pretty on it with this thing. I guess death is a good motivator, as everyone says. We got set up in the field and held it for an hour or so, and right as we were about to leave, we got PID, positive ID, on one insurgent firing towards Bravo's position. We all cracked off some shots, and then we ended up being there for another few hours. So we came back from that 7-hour mission, racked out for like 2 hours, and then woke up and kicked back out for another mission that ended up being 12 hours. I don't even know what we did, but I do remember it sucking, and there being a huge fucking IED that went off about 200 meters away from us, right where our original plan had us cutting across the river. Second time we've been lucky. Journal of Lieutenant Tim Hopper. Major Kevin Moyer commanded the 2nd Combat Brigade's engineering company, about 100 specialists in construction, breaching walls, bridging rivers, and blowing things up. He talked with Kandarian's operations and intelligence officers about the IED problem. A lot of anti-mine equipment deployed previously in Kandahar had been designed to clear roads. This included Mad Max-inspired bulldozers rigged with armored plates. Those wouldn't work on the narrow footpaths in the green zone, now claiming so many lives and limbs. Moyer and Lieutenant Colonel Clint Cox, the brigade's operations officer, fell into conversation about a Cold War-era mine clearance weapon called the Mine Clearing Line Charge, or MICLIC, referred to as a MICLIC. As a concept, the system dated back to the First World War. A modern Miklik resembled a 200-foot fire hose packed with explosives. A rocket was fitted to one end of the hose. When fired, the rocket shot out and laid the hose in a straight line on the ground. Then the rocket set off all the explosives in the hose. That massive detonation, in turn, set off any buried IEDs across a 15-foot-wide path, a cascade of thunderous booms. When the dust cleared, presto, infantrymen had a reliably safe path 100 yards long and 15 feet wide to walk. Miklik systems had been sent out in small numbers to Afghanistan, but they had never been used because they were considered too destructive for wars where hearts and minds figured. Art Kandarian was ready to bear that risk. The problem was, because of the length of its explosive hose, a Miklik had to be moved around on a wheeled trailer, which made it unwieldy in the dense green zone. Moyer was talking to other engineers when one mentioned a portable mini-Miklik called the Anti-Personnel Obstacle Breaching System, or APOBS. An APOBS consisted of two 25-foot explosive hoses that soldiers could carry in backpacks, fit together, and then detonate to clear out a 50-yard walkway. It turned out there were 10 APOBS stored at Kandahar Airfield. Special Operations Forces had brought them out thinking they might need them someday, but they had never been used. Moyer thought this was the coolest thing ever. They tried them out. It was fun to set off such huge explosions, and the systems offered the closest thing to a guaranteed safe walking path as there could be in that terrain, even if the path was only 40 yards long. And as the APOBS came in, engineers also started to clear road sections with the larger mine-clearing line charges. The weapons were not panaceas. They were heavy and awkward to deploy. They did not detonate every single buried IED, and the Taliban could implant new explosives overnight. But they were a lot better than the grappling hooks and improvised booby-trap detectors platoons had been given at the start. When Art Kandarian learned how effective the explosive hose systems might be, and how they raised troop morale, he tried to order as many as he could find. But the Pentagon balked. Army lawyers responsible for enforcing the battlefield's rules of engagement worried the explosive force was too great and too indiscriminate. There might be farmers hidden in the orchards who would be killed inadvertently. Kandarian created a PowerPoint deck arguing that the need was urgent, and that more lives and limbs would be lost needlessly if the army did not move fast. Petraeus endorsed Kandarian's position and peppered the Pentagon with emails to get the systems moving to Afghanistan. They found some lying in storage in Kuwait and had them shipped in. When Defense Secretary Robert Gates visited Kandahar in late summer, Kandarian used his time with the secretary to persuade him to speed up shipments, which Gates did. But it still took months to receive the approximately 250 APOBS and 100 Mikliks that Kandarian wanted. By the end of its tour, the 2nd Combat Brigade had detonated 207 explosive IED clearing hoses in order to fan out through the green zone. They also used highly flammable white phosphorus to burn out dense vegetation. They destroyed acres and acres of farmland, but slowly, over months, the brigade moved from desperation to tentative offense. Kandarian also begged Petraeus and Gates for help in obtaining more bomb-sniffing military working dogs. They had only 6 at the start. After Mikliks, dogs were the most popular anti-IED system at platoon level. The dog's effectiveness in identifying buried explosives was debated. The extreme heat took a toll on the animals. Also, a bomb-sniffing dog's effectiveness depended on his training and human handler, which meant that quality varied. Still, the dog's companionship was comforting and helped with the stress. And there were sergeants like Strickland who saw the dogs point out IEDs and save lives. Kandarian sent through to his companies as many working dogs as he could obtain. They, too, were frustratingly slow to arrive. July 17, 2010. I am getting pretty sick of these walk-around Jalawar patrols and SLEs, street-level engagements. I'm starting to feel like this is pointless. We just walk around and talk to people. It is just starting to turn into a grind. Well, coming up on the 25th, there is a big security clear operation, so we'll see what that does. I am so thankful that Jenny is such a faithful, loving, and good wife. Two of my soldiers and my PSG's wives are leaving them. I can't imagine doing all this with that weight hanging on my shoulders. Well, I am exhausted today since we spent all day dicking around. I'm going to go get some sleep. Journal of Lieutenant Tim Hopper. Secure the people. Connect the government to the people. Improve quality of life. The lines of operation on Art Kandarian's PowerPoint decks seemed increasingly at odds with the sheer amount of explosives and white phosphorus deployed to rip the Taliban out of the Agandab's foliage. Before arriving in Afghanistan, some of the brigade had trained at Freedom Town at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. Freedom Town was a training village set up to imitate conditions in Afghanistan. The soldiers practiced rudimentary Pashto and studied Islam and Afghan culture. Their scenarios had not touched upon how to persuade Afghans that blowing up orchards 100 yards at a time would contribute to their well-being. Counterinsurgency doctrine had a solution: cash payments. After the first 320th managed to clear at least some of the nests of IEDs around Combat Outpost Nolan, officers initiated a cash-for-work program to employ local villagers to clean up canals and fields. The first 320th was largely responsible for destroying the area. Now they paid the locals by the hundreds not to fight back. Officers had backpacks with 1 to 2 million Afghanis to fund these improvised payrolls. The exchange rate was about 40 Afghanis to $1 at the time. Villagers turned up at the outpost gate each morning for assignments. The soldiers used raid cameras to watch them from behind their HESCO walls to make sure the Afghans performed the work. Then they handed over cash at day's end. The brigade laid out larger sums as compensation for property destroyed by American operations, tens of thousands of dollars at a time, sizable fortunes locally. Army lawyers at Kandahar Airfield ran a kind of arbitration court to consider claims. The 2nd Combat Brigade had bricks of cash to pay successful applicants. The brigade's officers were scammed initially, at least by the standards of American law. Sharecroppers and day laborers in the Green Zone presented claims for damaged fields and buildings as if they were the owners. They accepted the biggest paydays of their lives and then disappeared. Only gradually did the Americans come to understand that the real landowners were in Kandahar City or Quetta. At one point, Karzai sent a commission to the province to investigate whom the brigade was paying. Karzai suspected an American conspiracy to undermine him politically. Ignorance was the reality. July 26, 2010. So, last night, it was super eerie when we were walking through an open field with loose dirt and hearing the insurgents out there talking about us. Last night was the first time I prayed. I was really nervous going through those fields. The fields had been flooded, so we were walking through tomato fields where the dirt was the consistency of thick chocolate pudding. So here we are, 100 men strong, sledging through fields of chocolate pudding, with half the people not having NODs, night optical devices, or speaking the same language while the enemy watches us as we approach the area where they plant all sorts of IEDs. Very comforting. So we were the platoon to push across the 2nd Canal to set up security around the compound we were supposed to seize. I had waterproofed my stuff, but apparently not well enough because the water was up to my chest at points as we crossed. All my stuff got soaked, and I almost fell over because the current was so strong. Journal of Lieutenant Tim Hopper. Objective Bakersfield was a four-way intersection of raised road controlled by the Taliban, naturally fortified by a large canal on one side. Beside the intersection was a compound of thick mud walls 3 to 8 feet high. Along the roads near the intersection were other heavily armed Taliban compounds. According to the 2nd Combat Brigade study, during the 1980s, the CIA-backed Mujahideen had managed to hold the intersection throughout their combat with Soviet forces. The Canadians and the American striker units deployed in 2009 had failed to take it. Whoever controlled the intersection could influence traffic between Kandahar and Zabul province. In late July, Kandarian prepared to have the 1st 320th assault the objective. Captain Venkat Motupalli, the battalion's intelligence officer, estimated that, on average, there was one hidden anti-personnel IED every 6 meters. The platoons, including Hoppers, opened the Battle of Bakersfield on July 30th. Hopper moved with a team leader he called his War Dog, a young Texan named Kyle Stout. They had played golf a few times before the Afghan tour and had become friends. Stout had two big blue stars tattooed over his nipples. He was a character, but also squared away as a soldier. The assault on Bakersfield was, by orders of magnitude, the most intense combat either of them had ever experienced. They quite literally charged across an open field into enemy fire, straight out of a video game or movie. As Motupalli put it, they kept going for 4 straight days. August 4th, 2010. Sergeant Stout is dead. Objective Bakersfield 1 was a goddamned hellhole that was rigged to kill everything that went in there. I don't even know where to start. The operation began with us getting pushed back 24 hours, and LTC Flynn telling us we need to change our plan because he wanted us to tighten up a few areas of it. Somehow we still ended up rushed and didn't have enough time to plan out things well and rehearse them. Next thing I know, we are entering right at the middle of the first field of the west part of the compound. Okay, well, we made it up to that point all right. And then an ANA soldier stepped on a small IED, but he was fine since only the blasting cap went off. He said his foot hurt a little bit. Okay. Pretty good indicator of how much this place is going to suck. We moved our security positions into place, and then we began going into the compound and clearing. Now, I should have supervised Sergeant Stout more and forced him to be more thorough. We cleared the first field and Building 1, so then he continued to clear Building 2. Sergeant Stout had torn up his pants just like mine, but his were much worse than mine were. Sergeant Stout just happened to not be wearing boxers. One of my last memories of Sergeant Stout was him standing there with everything hanging out. He was exhausted, as we all were, so I gave him my 5-hour energy drink. He was real pumped up about it. At that point, we had gotten to about Building 4, and it was slow going. Right as I got into the first courtyard of the east side, I saw Stansbury walking towards the west, and then there was a huge explosion. No one knew what had happened. I looked around the corner, and I saw half of a body laying in the middle of the intersection. His head was back and not moving, and he did not have any legs at all. We started moving up that way, and then all of a sudden there was an explosion right in the middle of the group of us. It was Sergeant Stout, Sergeant Hubbard, Sergeant Hatton, Alec, me. As the dust cleared, I saw someone on their back with their helmet blown off, and they were missing both legs from what I could see. I looked around at first, a little stunned, and didn't know what to do. I was scared to go up because of secondaries. I ended up just running up and pulled out a CAT and began putting it on Sergeant Stout's left leg. I saw his face as he looked down all confused, and then he saw his legs and just let his head fall back. When I got closer, I saw that his left arm had been blown off as well. They stayed in the fight for 3 more days. The last night I was there, I ended up sleeping in a body bag because it was so cold and we had nothing else. We all felt like gypsies. I think Sergeant Stout was fucking with us and looking out for us, because a dud, the only one in the 3 days we were mortared, landed right in the middle of the platoon. We all had to sit down with Captain Stone to talk about everything. We had to say where we were and how we felt when it happened. It was really hard, and there was a lot of tears let out and a lot of anger.